Welcome to the Wang Bennett's Podcast, celebrating West Virginia people, places, and the culture of Southern Appalachia. Now, here's your host, Wang Bennett.
Welcome to Wayne Bennett's podcast. I'm Wayne Bennett, and this is episode 114. It's September the 14th, 2023. Our guest today is a singer and songwriter, musician, Mr. Billy Payne. Welcome, Bill.
How you doing, Wayne? Thank you for having me.
Listen, we do have a connection. This is the first time that I've met you. I've heard you perform a couple of times, but my father-in-law, Dennis Pike, played local bands and regional bands for over 70 years, and you and he were big colleagues, got together a lot, and he thought the world of you.
Yeah, he was like a dad to me, really was. But a little bit of time I got to be around him, he was so nice to me.
And he was always looking forward. He'd call me and say, you know, Billy Payne sit in with us this Friday and whatever. So but we do have a connection. Now you were born in Page, West Virginia, weren't you?
Actually, I was born in Montgomery.
Montgomery,
West Virginia. Yes, sir.
You grew up in Page?
Grew up in Page. Yes, sir.
We used to go down there and play softball. There used to be a field down on the left down there, and everybody, the team I played for, we always liked to go down there because it had a short fence, and sometimes we'd hit home runs when we. There was a guy named Lloyd McKnight. I don't know whether you ever know him or not, but Lloyd used to have tournaments and stuff there, and it was a lot of fun at Page. Now, when you were 5 years old, you could got a Christmas gift that kind of got you started in country music.
Yeah, Mom and Dad bought me a Johnny Cash record, which was Live at San Quentin, and which is kind of a X-rated album for a boy my age at that time, with all the bleeps in it. and the Best of Charlie Pride. And I tell you, when I heard the Johnny Cash record, I was hooked. I was right there.
You were hooked.
My biggest hero right there, right off the bat, you know. And, but yeah, they bought that for me. And that's what got me started liking country music. Because I played that record over and over and over, even the Charlie Pride. I loved him too, you know.
Now you had, you got to tell the story about the bicycle you had with with your own stereo.
Well, it was a little bit later, probably around the time I was maybe 12, I guess. I was cutting grass for my grandmother over in Sophia, West Virginia. So I had to stay with her in the summertime, her and Grandpa. And she'd have me come over and cut her grass. So I got the big idea. I got my aunt's 8-track tape player. And I tied it to handlebars of my bicycle. And I'd go down to the store in the middle of town and buy those like flea market 8-track tapes. I was buying every kind of tape I could get a hold of, and I was listening to Elvis Presley and George Jones and everybody like that. And I'd have it on my bicycle handlebars, and I'd be riding through town listening to country music.
When you were in high school, when did you actually start playing the guitar?
Well, I've been playing the guitar most of my life. You know, just hitting at it, you know. I had some cousins that played, and I would go and sit and watch them play when I was younger. And about, like say, when I was about 12 years old, my dad bought me my first guitar. Uh-huh. And he bought it from that particular cousin. His name was Vesper Payne. We called him Junior. And he played, and his wife played, and his son played. And I would sit in with them, and I'd watch them play. And I had my eye on this guitar they had, man. It was a silver tone tuxedo, black and white, beautiful guitar. I still have today.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great.
And that's the one my dad bought for me. And he asked his cousin Junior, he said, would you want to sell that guitar? And he said, you give me what you got in your pocket and you can have it. And I remember my dad distinctively pulling out $12 out of his pocket, and that's what he paid for it. And it was when I was 12 years old, believe it or not. And I was just right there, man. I was happy as I could be. But I played a little bit from time to time until I got a little older, and then I laid it down for a while. And then the latter part of around the 80s, late 80s, I started playing a lot more. And then I got hooked up with a country music band up in Oak Hill at the Sport Lounge. A lot of people probably don't know where that's at, but it was where the right above McDonald there, where Advanced Auto is now. And a lot of people played there. Bill Morrison, Starlighters back in the day, and, you know, probably your father-in-law, I'm sure Dennis played there.
Yeah.
And I got my start there playing in a local band called Country Tradition. And then after that, I played with them about 6 months and branched out to a band called Bandolero. And it was the same guys, minus Eugene, but McClung, he was the guy that had Country Tradition band. But we would play on Friday nights for ourselves, and then we'd play on Saturday night for Country Tradition. And then after that, about 6 months later, I branched out on my own and formed my own band, Sidewinder. Then I went with Sidewinder, oh Lord, probably the next 10 years.
Really?
And then we won Star Search.
Now let's go back just a minute.
Okay.
You went to Oak Hill High School.
Yes, sir.
And you graduated, what, 79?
79.
When you were in high school, were you a good student?
I tried to be. Yeah, I never got in no trouble.
But was your wish to be a country star at that time, or what were you preparing to do life-wise?
Well, actually, I was going to go in the Air Force, and things didn't work out there. I never really, I mean, I wanted to be a musician. I didn't have the means to be at the time. But I ended up getting married right out of high school, and so I didn't take on my music career until the late 80s. You know, I mean, I had the love for it, wanted to be, wished it, dreamed, you know.
Now, when you were playing with the Sidewinders, mm-hmm. and you guys were together for a while, somewhere in there you met Waylon Jennings.
Yeah, I did. I carved a statue of Waylon for him.
Tell us about that statue. I've seen a picture of it.
I just had a friend, this is how it started, that was carving a statue of Hank Williams, and it was about a 700-pound log that
wow.
he was using. And I was just so impressed with that, you know, and I'd go up in the garage and watch him carve this. As a matter of fact, Sam Massey's guy done it, and he actually got it in Country Music Magazine. And so he told me, he said, you like this, don't you? And I said, yeah, but I could carve anything that big. And he said, well, he said, go down to your dad's and get a crib block, which a lot of people don't know this is a 4x4 post or a fence post or whatever you want to call it here. And or you use them in the mines. Dad had a bunch of them in the garage, so I happened to pick up a nice one. And he said, have your dad cut about 2 inches down from the top all the way around with a power saw, circular saw, and then bring it back up to me. I said, okay. So I did. And handed it to him, and he turned around, put the corner toward him, took his knife down below that cut and shaved off the corner and said, there's his nose, go get it. I'd never carved anything in my life. And so I could draw. I always was able to draw when I was a kid. So I just put my imagination to it, and I would look and cut, and it was like drawing, but it was just taken away.
Yeah.
You know, it's just reversed. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. And It took me 2 years, not straight 2 years, but 2 years. I'd say probably 10 months of cutting. And I carved him out from the cowboy hat to his boots, guitar and all.
Did you paint it?
Yeah, I painted it. I made a few little flaws on it, but I fixed it with the glue and the sawdust I had from it, you know. But it looked pretty good. I mean, he was getting a pretty good chord down here every time I got done. And I made the neck out of a different piece of wood. And I put strings on it. And I used watch bobs for the tone control and volume control and pieces off a watch band and guitar strings for frets and speaker wire for strings. And it, you know, it worked really good. And but when I got to give it to him, I made this thing in 84, finished it in 86, around the same time of the year in September. I remember it was like around Labor Day. Uh-huh. I finished it. And so they were sending me pictures from Waylon's office because I let him know I was doing it. 9 years later, I was able to give it to him.
Wow.
You know, I just didn't quit, you know. I'd seen Waylon at the Whelan Jamboree, which now I'm a member of myself, in 92. And I got a picture backstage through the MC of the show and of the statue. Had the information on the back. And about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from his manager. You know, he wanted to know if this was me. He had a hold of it. I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, I'm David Trask. I manage Waylon Jennings. And I said, oh, no, you don't neither. You know? He said, yeah. He said, I got a picture. Waylon wanted me to take care of that night. You were there, but you were gone. And I said, I didn't have tickets for a second show. And so Waylon wanted him to take care of it at that time. And but unfortunately, I'd already left. And they called me, and he asked me if I would like to send it to him. And I said, no, I don't want to send it. I said, if he wants it, he'll let me give it to him. So sure enough, 3 years later, we got it lined up. It took me a total, 9 years completely to give it to him. But I didn't give up, and I got to give it to him at Paramount in Kentucky. And he was just, I don't know, he was emotional about it. He really was. He had a tear roll down his cheek over it. I actually seen that.
Had you ever seen him live before?
Oh, yeah. I'd seen him 3 or 4 times before that.
Yeah.
Never did get to meet him until then. And but we became instant friends. It was really nice. And he stayed in touch with me by mail. You know, and we didn't get to talk on the phone. But he stayed in touch with me by mail, and he was getting ill pretty bad at the time. You know, he was having some rough times when I met him. And it wasn't long after that, you know, I cut my first album, and he was going to do liner notes. And he had just signed with Lucky Dog Records, and Lucky Dog said that they didn't want him putting anything on an independent label at that time.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, they'll let me put a picture of us in there together. They ain't going to stop that, so...
Was he died pretty young, actually 64 when he passed away, but he didn't take care of himself very well.
I wonder he didn't die when he was 30.
Yeah. I can recall they came and played at the when Ramada Inn one time was big, had some of these big groups in the Galaxy up on top, and I think Waylon played there one time and tore up the rooms. I don't think they invited him back, but you mentioned on a couple interviews some of your heroes were Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard and Waylon, and of course I love Merle Haggard. I've been a fan of his. I think he's one of the best entertainers and writers that's ever lived in music, and the best country concert that I ever went to, Merle Haggard was supposed to play over the Raleigh County Armory, and he got sick and couldn't come. And they rescheduled it. Well, when they had him over there, it was his first show back on tour. He had been out for 2 or 3 months, and it was his first show. And he put on the best show I've ever seen. He come out there, he did his 45-minute program, and then he come out and sit down, and he said, what else y'all want to hear? And he played another hour or so.
Yeah.
And it was good. And it was $5 is how much it cost to get
wow.
in. And he was, so I think I still have the ticket stub.
Yeah.
But I've seen George Jones twice.
Yeah.
And the first time he was in his prime, and he was really good. The second time was right near the end of his career,
right.
And he tried, mm-hmm. you know, but he just didn't have the pipes anymore.
Right.
He sang what people wanted to hear, and it was actually a good show. Marty Stewart had opened up for him, and then
yeah.
he was there, but. I never got to see Waylon Jennings live, and that's one of the things I regret. But all those guys kind of fit the same mold. Now you won a Star Search in 1998,
yes, sir.
In Charleston.
Mm-hmm. It was
what came out about that? I mean, how did that happen?
Well,
what happened afterwards?
Well, they filmed us for record executives, and sent it out to 200 record executives. We ended up getting 3 offers. So with the guys, you know, as we were, like say, we were working as a band, you know, they weren't really interested in doing anything to go. They wouldn't go accept their earnings and stuff on that deal. So anyway, the third offer came. I was offered to come to Nashville for Aaron Records, and I went. And I went ahead and decided to go, but still was a monkey on my back about the band. So I asked them if I could hang out about 2 weeks and make up my mind and call them back. And they said, sure. And I was probably taking a chance, but I did that because I wanted to ask the boys again. So they declined and I went. And that's how I started getting recognition. I was on this independent label with a guy named Jimmy Case. And he had helped Loretta Lynn go to Korea back in the day and had a lot of notoriety. He had an office in Nashville beside Mayborn Axton for a long time. And he was a good entertainer himself. When he called me, he just said, would you like to come to Nashville and record? And I said, well, I'd love to, you know. And I could hear me in the background. He was listening to the, watching the tape, you know. And so I asked him, I said, well, what about my band? He said, well, I'd rather not have your band. I'd rather have you. And I said, okay. I said, that's when I told him I'd call him in a couple of weeks. But anyway, what got me started on that deal is the first single I had out was the title of my album, No Limit on Love, that Freddie Weller wrote for me on this particular album. And Freddie and I got to become good friends over it, and I ended up getting a top 10 independent charting song at number 9 on the independent country. And that got me recognition overseas. And I think that's what started a lot for me. I mean, there wasn't anything going on here. Couldn't get nobody here to play my music. And still,
now did you get hooked up with Aaron Records at one time? Or
that, that was Aaron Records. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And that was, and with Ace Productions, Aaron Records, Ace Productions, Jimmy Case's organization. And after that, I end up with another top 10 that went to number 8. It was old Chuck Berry's song, Nadine. And that really blew up overseas a lot. But it's like saying that it was at selective radio stations across the country, but overseas a lot.
Yeah.
Well, there wasn't a, I mean, I still went to number 8 with Nadine as well as I did number 9 with No Limit on Love. But I guess it was just a lack of promotion, you know, on their part.
Now, how do you, when you use another artist, song like Nadine,
mm-hmm.
or and then later on you had an album that had was mainly all cover songs.
Yeah.
How do you pay them guys, or how, are you contract?
Pay.
How do you do that?
You pay, you get your license, you know, pay the royalties.
Okay,
and that, you know, that's the way it goes. And well, you know, I've had a lot of songwriters send me songs too, you know, that have never been recorded by anybody, you know, and of course, I've had about every album I put out, I've got something that somebody's had out, you know, or I like to reach deep way back, you know, and grab something that's not real current. You know?
Yeah. You actually played with Waylon Jennings' group, the Waylors, or they become the Waymores later?
Yeah, the Waylors, and I've toured with them. I went to Texas and many places, Detroit, up in Ohio, Alabama, went to a lot of places. wasn't a big stint, but it was enough to get me going with them. Because the first time I played with them was in Nashville at the Douglas Corner Bar there on 8th Avenue. They had contacted me earlier that year and asked me to come down and do a tribute to the Outlaws. And that Willie's band was going to be there and Waylon's band. Well, I jumped at the chance, you know.
Sure.
They heard me on a Canadian radio station with one of my songs called Wake Up and Smell the Whiskey, which was a song Tony Stampley wrote for me for my second album. And they liked it well enough to give me a call. Well, I knew Jerry Bridges because he was managing Waylon at the time and had been for a while. They called him Jigger. And when we got there, we started talking. And after I played my first set, Jerry asked me what I want to start recording with, just like that. And I had to look around and see if he was asking me a question because I wasn't sure. And he said, yeah, I'd love to do it. And he said, give me a little bit of time. We'll get in the studio. And that was in May of 2007. And in September of 2007 was the next time I got to play with him. That was in San Marcos, Texas. And Richie Albright was next door to me after the show that night, and he was Waylon's drummer for years. And he wanted me to sing a song to him that I had written about Nashville. And I sang it to him, and he said, that ain't nothing but the truth. We'll cut that first. Then within the month, I was in the studio in Mississippi, cutting an album. So,
well, now, he became your manager, Jerry Bridges.
Jerry Bridges did for a long time, yes.
Yeah. Was the album Country Till I Die? Which mm-hmm. Is that mm-hmm. the one you made then?
That's the first one I cut with them.
Around that time, you also, a couple years later, you had a gospel song, Bottle to the Bible.
Yeah, that was on the same album, Country to the Dial. Yeah, and that was a song that Jerry Bridges had written for me to do, you know. And actually, he said it was not a gospel song. It was just about a friend of his. And it turned out being a gospel favorite of mine. You know, the way it turned out.
Now, when you came out with the second album, did you go start playing with other groups to promote the album, or?
I was doing a lot of it myself. You know, I played a few more shows with them, and we did a gospel show in at the Ritz in Alabama, place where Elvis had played a lot back in the day. We did a gospel show there, and after that, I just came on home and put my boys back together and started promoting my music like I needed to and just played everywhere I could.
Yeah. Now, 2014 was a good year for you. You were accepted into the Wheeling Jamboree, and people that don't realize that, back in the old days, the Wheeling Jamboree was almost as big as Grand Ole Opry. I mean, it was broadcast all over the world back when we didn't have all the media and things we have now. And my buddy Darnell Miller, he's what accepted up there. He's played up there a few times. Who'd you play with the first time you played there?
Well, the first time I played Wheeling Jamboree was in 2001.
Okay.
At the Capitol, Music Hall with Billy Crash Craddock. And Lord, after that, I didn't play again until 2013. You know, I was invited back. And I got invited back a good bit. I guess I'd already played 6, 7, 8 shows maybe through the year of 2013. Cause I went back every chance I got. And then they asked me to join, I think it was in April 2014.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Now, who were some of the big names that you've played with? You mentioned Billy Crash Craddock, and then who are some of the other big names in country music that you have played or opened up for or played with?
Well, I opened up for Dale Reeves at the Nashville Palace.
Uh-huh.
In Nashville, the old palace. And Highway 101, Ronnie McDowell, 40 Days. Not a great many, but, you know.
I think I saw Lori Morgan's name somewhere.
Yeah, I did show Lori Morgan about 4 years ago. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. She's still pretty.
Oh, yeah. Yes, she sure is.
But also during that particular year in 2014, I was thinking you, somewhere along the line, you were also on Ernest Tubb's radio show.
I was on Ernest Tubb Midnight Jamboree
uh-huh.
with David Frizzell. And That was a really nice show. And that was around, I think it was a couple months before I did the Capitol for the first time. That was a really nice thing. I was on WSM radio all night. I started out at the Jamboree that night, and I remember David Frizzell saying, "Well, you're just going to be on WSM all night long, aren't you?" And I got on it after that, and we went on at 2 a.m., and we were on air until about 6. And I was on with Johnny K. Coble, and it was really nice. Johnny really spotlighted, you know, showcased me a lot that night. And there was a storm going on outside, and so we weren't going anywhere, so he just kept me on the radio.
Just flying.
He played my whole album, you know. It was pretty cool, yeah.
One of your songs that you, I know my father-in-law would have liked this one. You had a song called Call Me the Breeze, and he had a band called The Cool Breeze. And I actually listened to it yesterday. But you played it, played at State Fair. You had an album called Genuine Leather, came out about around somewhere in that time.
Yeah.
You've kind of followed the protocol of Waylon Jennings as an outlaw, and he was considered an outlaw because he told the labels what songs he wanted to play, what studios he wanted to play in, and what musicians he wanted to have.
Right.
But you know, he was an established star. Do you think the outlaw image might hurt you or help you?
Well, so far I think it's helped me. I never proclaimed to be an outlaw singer. I never did do that. But the title was stuck on me by Whalers. You know, they said, "Hey, Billy, you know, you've already established yourself as an outlaw singer because you're recording with us."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, so, but I never did. I don't say I'm an outlaw or anything like that, but I fall in the branch of the genre of it. But I think I fall in the branch of traditional country a lot. I highly respect it, and that's one of the things that Richie Albright was very nice to me about, because he made the comment that I respected what they did out of all the artists they've showcased to play on this particular tribute show, that I was about the only one that respected what they did. And that meant a lot to me. And he said, "Not only that, Billy knows every live cut we've done and every studio cut we've done." So, and I was like, "Well, that's a little bit far-fetched there." But, you know, he liked it, the way I would do the song, you know. But he said, "The best thing about you is that you're you."
Yeah.
"You're not trying to be." And when you're told that by guys that's been with him that many years off and on, then I know I'm doing the right thing. That's something Waylon told me a long time ago. He said, "If you be true to yourself, you'll go somewhere."
That's kind of the problem that I have with country music right now. I mean, I like country music, but most of the time I listen to the classic radio approach shows and stuff. I don't, I'm not a real big Keith Urban fan. I'm not a big Jelly Roll fan. I just can't, and not saying that they aren't talented. I just don't like that type of, I don't even consider it country in a way. But and then the name Jelly Roll, I mean, gee, I can't follow somebody named Jelly Roll. I mean, if the, what's going to come next, donut or pop tart or whatever, but he has a couple of good songs. But I kind of still go back to guys that are still around, Chris Stapleton and Jamie Johnson and Sturgill Simpson, guys like that, one of the songs I like the best that Waylon put out, besides Mamas Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Cowboys, was a song that he borrowed from W. Gray, you know, Drifting Away.
Oh, yeah.
And it started out as kind of a rock song, and then he picked it up, and it was written for him. I mean, he did a great job with that. But the roots of country music, I don't know what's selling out there now. You know, you got These guys like Luke Bryan and Jason Aldean and some of them, I mean, they draw a younger crowd. But I think you've made a couple statements in the past about how young people are starting to come back to the...
Oh, yeah. It's really a strange thing. Ever since I've been playing, I've had a lot of following with teenagers anyway. They come up to me and said, Billy Payne, we never liked country music till we listened to you. And so I finally ask, well, what is it about me you like? Well, you tell stories when you sing, you know, and I do tend to write like that. You know, I try to take it from my life or somebody else's experience. But the kids nowadays, they seem to like the older stuff because they get more out of it. You know, well, like me, I mean, that's what I'd rather hear. Not putting anything down, but it's more about life than it is a fantasy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the best way I could probably put it. But it's, you know, I know there's a lot of novelty songs out there, and Lord, I'd probably cut them too, you know. But I think the younger crowd is, I don't think country music ever left. I really don't. I think it might have got pushed aside a little bit, but I think that country music is going to get a real strong hold because there's so many young people wanting it. I mean, you can walk up to you and say, you remind me of Hank Williams. Well, that's the biggest compliment I ever had in my life. And I, you know, and it's from a kid that don't even know who Hank Williams was.
Yeah.
And such a compliment. I mean, and I had that said to me by a 15-year-old.
You know, well, as we talk, I think Hank Williams' birthday was yesterday, and he would have been 100 years old if he would have lived. So it's been a while.
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. Way before my time.
But now you have been you've got a lot of play time over in Europe, airtime, and you've been over there on tour. Tell me about that. I mean, tell me about the tour.
Well, in 2017, I got to go to Belfast, Ireland, and I did a stint over about 3 weeks. I got over there by a gentleman named Mervyn Newell, and he and I had been friends for a good little while. He was an Irish friend that got in touch with me on the internet. We became friends like that. And we'd known each other probably about 14, 15 years before I got over there. And he was striving like crazy to get me there. So, and that was from the first CD. I mean, my No Limit on Love. And he said, Billy, you just got to come over here because you are so country. I mean, it's what we really like. But anyway, when I got to go, fast forward to going over there, I was there 3 weeks, and I got to play the Phil Mack show, which is probably the biggest thing in Ireland, you know, as far as country music. Phil Mack comes to the Opry in Nashville. He goes to all the Country Music Award shows. And he has all kinds of artists there from different parts of the world. And I was fortunate enough to get on one of his shows, and I was on Leona Williams. And it was really a nice time. And was in Armagh City. And then after I did the show, I got to tour around and do some TV stuff and some radio stuff in different parts. And pretty close to Dublin, I was down in Dundalk. And then I was up in, there's another town I can't think of. But anyway, there was a record store called Stewart's Record Store in Dungarvan, something like that. And they were promoting my new album at the time, Maverick Hillbilly. And what was funny about it, I never will forget that about everybody walked up to me and asked me, what movie did I just play in? Because they said I looked like a Western star on the front of my... And I said, well, I've never played the movie, not yet. But, they was really intrigued about me because I really looked the part, they thought, you know.
Well, a lot of these people didn't even speak English. So how did they like country music?
In Ireland, they speak English all the time.
Yeah.
And they were really glad that I was there because they just was so excited about Americans being there. And especially if we sang, you know. And I got hooked up with a gentleman named Crawford Bell. And we did a recording session together. We did a duet recorded in Ireland, a thing called Good Old Boy, Bad Old Girl, which he wrote for me to do, done a duet. And it hit the charts over there. It was at number one 5 different times on play charts, whatever they call them. And Crawford is at times the backup singer for Daniel O'Donnell, the Irish singer, and also Van Morrison.
Wow.
And so Crawford really liked me a lot. We've been talking off and on since then about getting me back over there, but COVID done a lot, you know, about getting back over there. And Crawford still pitching me songs, wanting me to cut some stuff with him. Cut 3 songs over there. I cut 3 songs. I wrote one that I had to have that called Country Dance on Saturday Night, which is doing really good now. I just released it. Kept it in my pocket for a long time. And I wrote that one with a gentleman, with my friend Mervyn's brother, Roy. He was a poet over there, you know, a poem. And so he got together with me and we wrote this song about country dance. It started out as an Irish dance, but he said, "What can you do with it?" And I said, "Well, I can turn it into a country dance, I think." So we worked on it. The guy got it and they cut that song. And also we cut my song that I had a hit on called Only Miss You When I'm Sober.
I've heard that one.
So I've cut all 3 of them songs over there, and I held on to Only Miss You When I'm Sober for the album I have out now. But we recut it. The other 2 cuts in Ireland, they're original the way they were. But and I don't think that the Good Old Boy, Bad Old Girl has ever been heard here, as far as I know. You know.
Now, you've been... Over the years, I mean, you've received a lot of nomination stuff for Josie Awards and the Fair Play Country Music Awards and things like that. And I think you're nominated now for 2 or 3 categories of Josie Awards. What song is it that's receiving the nominations?
Country Dance on Saturday Night's up for Song of the Year.
Okay.
Fit to Be Tied, I think, is up. It might be cover. And I just won an award in Holland for that one. And I'm up for Outlaw Artist of the Year. There was a couple more. Fan Choice and Album of the Year with Josie's. But you know, my first biggest thing that ever happened to me, besides the awards I got for first album, I got those in Nashville for the singles back in 2001, is when I was nominated for the Will Rogers Award.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. That was the Bottle to the Bible song, wasn't it?
Well, the first time, it was for the Genuine Leather CD. Yes, sir. I'm pretty sure it was for Bottle to the Bible.
Okay.
And artist and also album of the year, Genuine Leather. And I was nominated 4 years in a row. I didn't win any of them, but I got my certificates. But another thing that happened... It's the Will Rogers Award, they call it the Willie, through the Academy of Western Artists. That's out in Oklahoma. And how that happened was I was just happened to be on Facebook one day, and I got a message from a guy named Bobby Newton. Said for me to call this number, and I did, and I didn't know what it was. I called, had to leave a message, and then the executive director of the Gene Autry Museum in Gene Autry, Oklahoma, Leslie Fisher, called me and said, "Congratulations, you know, you've been nominated for Artist of the Year." And I didn't know what to think, you know. And I was getting ready to go to Littlefield, Texas and do a show for a bunch of Waylon's family and friends. And a lady from Australia, Barbara Dowling, that was with the television and radio people over there in Australia, in Melbourne, she was a big fan of mine for 10 years, and she booked me in Littlefield, Texas, when she was there to do this show. And she also got my interview on the old KLLL radio station there where Waylon had worked. And she had knew Waylon and Jesse really well. Been friends for 40 years. And Barbara wanted to showcase me in Littlefield, you know. And so she got me there, and she was blind, and she traveled there alone from Australia, and she would stay in Littlefield for 3 months, you know, at a time. But But she continued to keep going well after Waylon had passed. She was doing her ever best to help me out. She got me on New Country Television in Australia. I had number one song with Gypsy video. And I didn't know that until Bob Brunner announced it on the Little Jimmy Dickens tribute, Hammerrock. I had no idea I hit number one over there on the video.
Wow.
But you don't get much notoriety, you know, around hometown, especially media, has been kind of rough on me, you know, right here.
I remember seeing something you said. You really enjoyed playing. One of your most favorite places was Belfast, Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
Said the people received you very well out there.
Yeah, you know, that was in Armagh City that night with Bill Mack's show. Those people were great.
Now, you put a band together again, and I know a couple of those guys, they're great musicians. You've done a great job. I got to hear you sometime. And when you played over at the Little Reunion, I was out of town. I couldn't get here, but I wanted to hear. But tell us a little bit about the band you got now.
The Gypsy Outlaws. Yeah. Now, I put that band together probably about 10 years ago, and I just kept the name, you know. It'd been several, you know, band people in that. But I put it on hold for a while because I was playing a lot of local shows without anybody. But I'd go out of town, I'd use pickup bands, you know. And that's what I'd been doing for the last 10 years, with pickup bands everywhere I'd go. So I guess the whole boys got together and they had a meeting. After I talked to my friend Bobby Holly and another gentleman named Tommy Akerd, we were talking one day. And next thing I know, they wanted to know if I wanted to come and see them, you know. And so I went in and talked to them at their Marty Cole studio uptown. And they said, "We want to play your music." You know, because I'd even mentioned to Bobby and Tom that it's hard to get local musicians to play your original stuff. Mm-hmm. I've never tried to drive it down anybody's throat, but I've tried not to be just a cover guy, you know. But anyway, they were so gracious to get together and put a band together for me. And they have absolutely made me a happy man. They really have. I mean, they're playing my music. I've got Bobby Holly on the keys. I've got Pete Urban on the bass, Marty Cole on drums, and a guy named Brian Thomas on chicken picking monster guitar, man. I tell you, he's just something else. All the guys are great. I mean, they're absolutely well-established musicians. And it makes me emotional at times to hear them play my music. Mm-hmm. It really does. And I never, ever had that happen. I always had trouble. You know, when I put boys together to play my songs, they'd either want to simplify it or not learn it at all. You know, and I just didn't feel good like that. You know, and Jerry Bridges, he told me that in Mississippi. We just played in Tupelo at a TV station there on the morning show. And we were having dinner, and he said, "You're going to have a hard time. After you do this with us, you're going to have a hard time putting musicians together." I didn't really understand. I didn't understand him at the time, but I do now. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's got a lot to do, I think, with respect, Wayne. You know, I mean, I don't proclaim to be better than nobody. But I think I was looked at in the wrong kind of sense from a lot of people. I never thought that I was better. And I tell you, I am my own musician. I'm not, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not nobody perfect at all, no means. I know what I want to hear, and I know what I want to do. And I go after it the best way I can. These boys, these men, let me just put it that way, these gracious men that are playing with me are showing me how much they care. Mm-hmm. And how much they even told me, "Your music needs to be heard." And, you know, and thank God that I have had a lot of media coverage as far as across country and overseas. I have spread it out here myself. That's why I was playing the tracks a lot, because I was promoting my music and I was selling a lot of music. But now I've got the energy behind me, the boys.
That's good.
It feels good.
Well, you know, something I've noticed, and we've mentioned this on our show with other people before, back in the old days, locally, a band, if you had a band, that was who you played with. But now, guys or you play in a band, and it doesn't mean they're disloyal, but some guys will still play solo. Some guys might play in another band.
Right.
And I've known a couple of guys that's played three or four bands at the same time, mm-hmm. you know. And but it's nothing. It's just they like to play. They like the music. Yeah. They like the people they play with. Oh, yeah. And, you know, that's better. The more the better as far as I'm mm-hmm. concerned. But you had a... You made a statement one time that, you know, if you've got a dream, go after it and don't let anyone tell you that you can't do it. And one question I have, and I do appreciate you coming and talking to us, but we would love to, on our podcast, we always play an introductory song at the beginning of our podcast. And we've had some local musicians. We try to use local musicians. We've had the Untrained Professionals. We've had Matt Mullins and the Bring Downs. And we've mm-hmm. had Alabaster Boxer. And if you, with your permission, we'd like to use one of your songs as our absolutely. Introductory for a couple months. And sure. if you don't mind, I
yeah,
appreciate
I love that.
Well, I thank you for coming by
thank
and talking to
me.
Us. And one thing I can attest to... Billy Payne, you're your own man, and keep on doing your good, buddy. And
thank you.
You're gonna play a song for us, hopefully.
Yeah.
Now we're not in a studio or anything like that, but I know you'll sound good. But anybody else out there that would like to be on our program, you can contact me at awbennett50@gmail.com, and we'll get you on here. And until next time, remember, if you're not dead yet, you're not done yet, and God bless you.
I've been coming here now for several years. All the street signs are the same, but nothing's here. Buildings I remember all are gone. In the distance, I don't hear a country song. The rhyming's just a place when they want to change. And the Grand Ole Opry House just ain't the same. The legends are almost gone, and all we hear are pop songs. And Nashville ain't the same anymore. Nashville ain't the same anymore. Music Row rolled up the street and closed the store. Opryland is gone, all they have now is a mall. Nashville ain't the same. Drive by some of the places where I've been. They closed down the Nashville Palace and built a new one instead. It's a crying shame. Only memories remain. Lord, ain't it strange nobody says a thing. The Nashville ain't the same anymore. Rolled up the street and closed the store. Poppy land is gone, and all they have now is a mall. Nashville ain't the same anymore. They tore down the Hall of Fame, built a new one, but it ain't the same. Nashville ain't the same anymore. Without old Waylon Johnny Cash, city has lost its class. Nashville ain't the same anymore. Nashville ain't the same.